You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello there and welcome to the show. Just before I bring you this episode recorded earlier this year at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival with dazzling American comedian Orlando Baxter, who I believe will be up at the Edinburgh Festival this year, so check him out there. Just a little notice though, if you are in London in the first week of August, if you have eschewed Edinburgh or are going there later, or if you're in Britain or anywhere in the world and can get to London in the first week of August, get yourself to the Soho Theatre and watch Luke Heggie. His show is called Rough Diamante and he is just such a phenomenal comedian. I saw this show earlier this year in Melbourne. I've seen a couple of his shows in the past. He was a very early guest on the podcast sometime in the double figures. And he is just one of my very favourite comedians. He's like a merciless deadpan sniper. And he just takes no prisoners. And it's beautifully written, beautifully emotively performed. I cannot recommend him enough. Go along and see that. And if you did miss Peter and Bambi Heaven in The Magic Inside, they're reprising that show in London sometime in the next couple of months or so. Have a little check for that. That's Asher Trelevin, formerly of this podcast, and Gypsy Wood as well, doing an incredible husband and wife, ludicrous, bad magic act type double act. But there are more than one of them around. That's a genre of itself, you know, the kind of bad magic. But holy hell, they do it so well. I put this on the Facebook group earlier on. I genuinely mean it. I laughed myself hoarse. I couldn't speak for a day and a half because I had shouted with laughter at this brilliant show. That's Peter and Bambi Heaven. So check that out on Facebook or the internet or wherever you find out your information. Now let's get stuck into this episode with Orlando Baxter. Orlando Baxter, you're in Melbourne. How are you enjoying Melbourne?
I am loving Melbourne. First time here in Australia. Obviously, first time at this festival and enjoying it immensely.
It was your first Edinburgh as well, was it?
It was my second Edinburgh, but it was my first time doing an hour there. The year before, I went and did like 10 days. I did a free show. And I did like 30-minute spots just to see how it was.
I did not know that. That was the previous year, so that was 2015?
Yes, that was 2015. That's actually where somebody seen me. Mick Perrin actually seen me there during 2015, and that's how I ended up getting signed and brought back with him the next year.
Okay, that's a pretty successful story of that taking a chance on a festival.
Yes, I could have left after like the sixth show. So, you know, I was like, all right, I met this dude. He's going to bring me back next year. I'm done.
But great.
I continue to do it.
So what inspired you as a comic? Where are you based in the U.S.?
I'm based out of Boston, Massachusetts. What inspired me, two things actually inspired me. Hannibal Buress, a comic from the U.S., inspired me. I was opening for him in Connecticut back in, I want to say it was like 2013 or 2012. And we were having lunch, and he just was telling me about Edinburgh, and he's like, yeah, man, you should do it. You know, I've been doing it for like, at this point, I've been doing it for like 2 years. He's like, yo, it's hard, but it's good, man. It's a great way to just meet a bunch of other comics and kind of just get up, you know, a bunch of times for long sets. But he said it's really difficult, and that part of it intrigued me already. And then what happened was I did this festival, my first international festival in Switzerland. And I heard some other comics talk about it. And this was back in 2015. And then I was like, I gotta at least try. And then I realized how expensive it was.
What did you interpret when Hannibal said it was difficult? What were your expectations of, like, what kind of difficulties was he?
I think he was talking, well, I was intrigued by the difficulty of the audience. Just the idea that culturally, it's a lot different than the States. And how would that impact the material that I had? So I was just interested to see how I would do there, because to me, he's a phenomenal comic. And for him to tell me that it was difficult,
yeah,
made me think, whoa, what is this? It was just, you know, as I think sometimes as Americans, I'll just speak for myself, just as a comic, I just think that Americans in general, you just kind of think of in terms of America, and that's it. And I really didn't think of anything international at that point. So Hannibal kind of brought that idea to mind, like, oh, you can do comedy overseas and it's challenging. I'm kind of funny. I want to see if I can make them laugh over there. So okay. And it was very difficult. That 10 days
What was the room? Which room were you playing?
I was at the Cabaret Voltaire.
Oh, I know it. Yeah, yeah.
And it was very difficult because there was one room. At the same time, there was one guy playing a guitar.
Sound bleed from
the... I had two guys playing guitars. One was an electric guitar. One was acoustic on the other side. And it was just tough. And I didn't like the idea of barking, like handing out the flyers.
Sure.
Like I bought a bunch of shit. And then it's already difficult, man. Like dealing with the jet lag, because I came midway through the festival.
So you arrived and it's already going off in every direction.
It was, first of all, it was just chaos seeing all of this. It was like being at, like, I don't even know how to describe it, but it was just like this beautiful thing, but this scary thing at the same time, because you're people out there flying, and then you're getting fucking rejected. And then I'm like, fuck, man. And then you do the shows, and I didn't know there was a bucket. That was a new thing for me. I was like, what the fuck is this bucket for? And they was like, oh, you put money in it after. I was like, oh, I like this bucket. This is a good bucket. So that was a good experience. And then, like I said, I had... Mick Perrin had came down and seen one of my shows. I had met him, though, maybe 9 months before when I did this festival in Switzerland. And he said he was going to be there. And he said, let me know if I have a show. And I sent him out an email. But he didn't say he was going to come to the show. I just asked him for suggestions. And then he surprised me. And he came to one of the shows. There was 8 people in there.
How did you... I mean, that's obviously one of the difficulties of working at the Edinburgh Festival, the insane amount of competition. I believe it's the biggest festival in the world. I think... I'm sure it's the biggest comedy festival in the world, that open access kind of nature to it.
I totally agree with you. It was tough, man, because it was just like... When I did the show, it was kind of like I had to... I probably did about 4 or 5 shows, and then he came to that, like, 6th or 7th show... And I was kind of sick, and I wasn't used to hanging out to 5 a.m.
Yeah, I was trying to interpret that. When he says kind of sick, do you mean like ill? Because of festival flu, or do you mean you've been going hard till 5 a.m.?
It was a combination of both. It was like, ugh. Like one of my buddies who was actually signed with Mick at the time said, hey, man, I think he might come down to one of your shows. So he kind of gave me a little heads up, but it was like an hour before the show, and I didn't feel well. And I just was like, man, I just got to power through this, because my expectation wasn't something was going to happen from it. But I just wanted him to see, you know, like, hey, see me do a longer set as opposed to the shorter set that you seen me at the previous festival. And I did the show. I did a little crowd work. At one point during some crowd work, I wasn't trying to do crowd work, but I said something and then some old lady had yelled out. I forgot what the question was. I said the N-word. And I said something like, oh, you know what that means? And this old lady, she had to be at least 75. She was like, nigga! And I was like, and I said, God damn. I was like, it was crazy. But then the response that I had was perfect for what, I forgot what the response was.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. And it just clicked. And then even though it was a small group, it went well. I thought it went okay. And then after the show, you know, I'm out there and I had the bucket. And, it was not a lot of people, but they put money in it. And then after, he was like, hey, what are you doing after this? I said, oh, nothing. And then he was like, hey, we want to take you out to eat. We want to talk to you about something.
Great.
A success story.
Then you get there and he's like, do you want to buy this car?
Yeah, great. Oh, that's what we're talking about. Well, that's fantastic. So just paint a picture for us. How different, obviously it's a festival as opposed to a kind of a day-to-day gig.
Yeah.
But what does it look like working in Boston? Can you stay in Boston or are you traveling outside of Boston?
No, yeah.
I've never worked there. I've got no idea what it's
like. Yeah. I definitely travel outside of Boston. I open up for a couple of some of the bigger national headliners. I open up for a guy named Joe Coy and Whitney Cummings, which is another comic in the U.S. She wrote the show Two Broke Girls. I'm not.
Yeah, I knew the name from somewhere. Okay, got it.
But I've been opening up for those two every now and then, a couple of times a year, maybe about 10 to 12 times a year. But aside from that, I do my own stuff. So there's a bunch of clubs in the States, obviously. So I'm mainly based in Boston, but I perform everywhere, all over New England, New York, the West Coast, East Coast, everywhere. I do a lot of colleges and universities as well.
Okay, because that's something that's, there's no real equivalent here. I mean, there is a college circuit, but it's small gigs, nothing like the same money, nothing like the same number of them.
Yeah.
That's something the metric I have for the college circuit in the US is that I know Stephen Wright recorded the album I Have a Pony and then toured colleges for 20 years doing that material. That's what I've heard, at least.
Yeah.
That you can just, the country is big enough and the work is sufficient enough that you can do that for the rest of your career if you want to.
Yeah, I mean, the money is unbelievable. I think it's...
just to clarify, unbelievably good.
Unbelievably good for somebody that is not, obviously not Stephen Wright, but just for any comic that gets into the university, kind of like college circuit, it's very difficult to kind of get into because you can't just get into it. You know what I mean? You can't, like, it's, they got like the system wrapped up. There's a thing called NACA, which is like National Association for Campus Activities. And you kind of have to have an agent, and the agent submits your performance to NACA, and then, you know, they take 20% of whatever the hell you get. But if they select you and you get a bunch of colleges, it could be very lucrative for you.
And how long have you been doing that?
I've been doing those for about 2 or 3 years.
And what are the good things about working in that environment? What are the less good things?
The good thing for me is I was a high school teacher for a number of years, 12 years. And so for me, it's kind of like talking to my students, like, but obviously using profanity and other things and saying what I really want to say as opposed to holding back.
Sure, which has to, from their point of view, that's got to go down.
Yeah,
really well, because
yeah,
you're like a sort of a treacherous member of the,
yes,
the school governing body, you know, the teaching. You're on the other side of the fence and you need to tunnel back up.
Exactly. I'm kind of like giving it to them real and raw. But at the same time, it's difficult in the sense that I'm used to being in clubs, and a club is it's a different ball game. Like, it's, you know, there's alcohol, there's...
Oh, yeah, of course. There's no alcohol?
No alcohol.
Because in the student gigs in the UK, there's a bar. There's a student union bar. That's the reason there's a gig on it, so they can get the students there to sell them beer.
Yeah, because you got to think that in the States, you need to be 21 to drink, and kids graduate usually when they're 22. So a lot of times, the majority of kids are like 18, 19, 20. And I think another thing that's a little bit difficult with the colleges is these students, a lot of times, never been to comedy shows, like college campus shows. So, and they're kind of sensitive to certain material. And a lot of times you have difficulty in kind of figuring out, you know, what's too much for them.
it sounds like you're alluding to a specific event or events where you've gone too far.
Yeah, well, you go to, well, you kind of know, because sometimes they'll tell you, hey, you know this or know that, or, you know, a lot of times they won't, and sometimes they won't say anything, but it's just, I think, the shock of stand-up. I think what's helpful a little bit is obviously with YouTube, and they can kind of get a sense of comedy from what they see, and Kevin Hart, guys like that that are kind of bigger on TV. But a lot of times they just, this is their first time in a situation for kids on campus, I'm speaking specifically, where there's somebody on stage and they're not a professor or not a teacher.
Yeah, right.
So it's a little bit weird to have that, this other energy coming back at them, and sometimes they don't know how to deal. Did he just say fuck me? You know what I mean? And it just kind of like, they don't know how to react to it, but it's cool. I like it. I enjoy it.
And how are those gigs regarded in? I mean, this is an insane question to make a sweeping generalization. How are those college gigs regarded? Is that something like that is looked down upon by any section of the comedy population?
Yeah, of course it is. I think it is. Not. It depends on how old you are. Like, I think that in the when you've been doing it for a while, I think it becomes difficult in the sense that you get older as a comic, and the things that you probably want to talk about are kind of outdated to like some of the younger guys, the younger college campus crowd. So you kind of feel like, all right, I got to kind of keep up with
what they say. Some Pokemon Go jokes.
Yeah, it's like, I don't want to do that shit. And I think that that's, I wouldn't say it's looked down upon, but I think that if you're, you won't see a lot of older individuals kind of doing that racket. I think some of my material kind of plays towards that crowd in general, just because it's school related. But, I mean, it's not my favorite. I do it, and I do enjoy doing it. But the one thing I will say, though, it is, it's the key for me, at least, what I learned is you can't treat it like a comedy club. You got to treat it like they're college kids. So it can be a little bit more relaxed, and you can kind of talk to them a little bit more as like almost being like a funny big brother.
Okay.
And but have a message or whatever with the show.
Sure.
Whereas with the college, like, you can't do that at clubs.
Yeah.
I don't think they're drunk, they're older, they don't got the fucking patience for that.
Yeah, man, I was in LA last year and I went to the Comedy Store. Mm-hmm. And yeah, obviously there are huge differences between, I mean, have you done clubs in the UK, or have you just been?
Yeah, no, I think that's the first time I met you. Was a club in the UK. We did, I want to say it was either Top Secret or...
Yeah, there we go. Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. I tell you what I have in mind as our first meeting was, of course, Setlist. So we are bonded forever by having done Setlist together.
Yes, that was the first time. I did it twice. I've done Setlist at Edinburgh. First time was obviously last year. And amazing. Like, because I've never done anything like that before.
Sure. Setlist, for the listener, is it's a kind of a comedy format game experiment sort of at night where you are given on a screen behind you. So it's inescapable. You can't run away from it. What is your supposed setlist? So they will put a deliberately difficult topic up there and you have to look at it. And then the audience is in on it as well. And they know that you're now going to try and pretend you have immaculate material on this subject. How did you find that night? It was a tough night, right?
That was a very difficult night. How did I find it? I enjoy it, because it's like, first of all, I think I got a little advantage being not from there.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Oh, 100%. In the same way, I mean, I'm getting to experience that in a very welcome way, being in Melbourne.
Yes.
Like being right, like, oh, he's an English guy.
Yeah.
Let's give him fractionally more attention than we
are. A little bit more, yeah, exactly. A little bit more attention. And I think it works with me as well, because I'm very laid back. My delivery, so I have more time to think. That's all I'm basically saying. So because I'll drag out a word where I'm really just thinking, or pause, but the pause seems normal.
Yeah, okay. That's really interesting to hear that, because I often think that when I see slower paced acts. I'm like, you fuckers, you're able to. You're buying yourself thinking time. You're the first person I've ever admit that.
Yes, I can admit it. So, but I do enjoy it. Like, I just, it was something that I seen. I said, oh, I want to try it. I seen Trevor Noah do it the year before.
And, he was doing it the first time I did it a few years ago. It's Trevor Noah and Richard Herring. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, I seen it and I was like, oh, this is.
It's like the leveler. Backstage, you're bonded, right?
Yes.
It's like, oh my God, you've got big famous acts there going.
Yeah, you see him sweating. And I said, oh, I got to at least try it once. And I did it the first time and it went really well. The second time, I think it went well. It was tough, but it went well. But I just like it, like, because it's, you can't prepare for that. No matter what you do, you can't prepare. Maybe some guys are just naturally gifted. And I'm not one of those guys that, it's weird. I just have to go with whatever's in my head at that time. I'm not a guy that knows everything going up, or I'm drunk. so I can just kind of like, let the alcohol fucking take control of me.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but it was good. How'd you enjoy it?
I enjoyed that one. I remember the first time I ever did it, that I said, how long have I got? And they said, as long as you want. And I looked at my, it takes you right back to your first gig.
Yes.
Because you just, the fear is back, the adrenaline's back. And I looked at my watch after I came off, I'd done 17 minutes. Right? Because no one flashed me.
Yeah.
And I guess, I didn't get booked for a few years. I don't know if that had anything to do with it, or maybe I just didn't approach them. I was ashamed. So that one, when I saw you, I think that's only the second time I've done it. I really enjoyed that one because I felt like I had more of a handle on this is the thing.
Yes.
And I can jump out with no safety net and just try and come up with something. I did enjoy that one.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it's interesting what you say there about, like, I'm not that guy.
Yeah.
So what kind of guy are you within stand-up? What do you think? I saw your work in Headliners last night, which I really enjoyed. I've seen your Conan set with some of the same material, delivered in a smarter jacket.
Yeah. That was my agent's fault.
It's great. Good move, I think. It's a good marketing move.
So this is Orlando. Thank you so much to him for coming along onto the show. Thanks to you for listening. Thank you to Barry. And thank you to everyone that emailed to tell me how much, and is still emailing as we speak, to tell me how much you enjoyed the episode with Barry Cryer. If you haven't heard that one, if you're an American comic and you're sifting through these just listening to the Americans, then do yourself a favor and download a 2-hour slice of British comedy history from an absolute legend, Mr. Barry Cryer, old Bazza himself. That's the previous episode to this one, so you can find that down on your iTunes feed or wherever else you get your podcasts. And why not use that opportunity to step in and leave a nice pithy review, especially if you're outside of the UK. I'm going to read you a typical email now. This is from Paul. He says, "Hi Stu, algorithm updated. You were the lucky one who got to talk with Barry Cryer for 2 hours, and I got to listen to it this morning on my commute to work." 2-hour commute, he'll explain in a second. He said, "This is the third time I've donated to the Boutros Fund, and if you don't want to read any more, no worries, I'm a cool guy." Now, what that means, if you're new to the show, is that he's happy for me not to reply at length. If you want to put PS, I'm a cool guy, on any correspondence with me, info@comedianscomedian.com, then that basically lets me off the hook and lets me read a fabulously long and evocative and emotive email that you've sent me without feeling ashamed and terrible like I have to reply in similar length, which I never have time to do. So he says, "I'm a cool guy. Suffice to end the start." I don't know what that means. Maybe that's a typo. "With Barry fucking Cryer. The middle bit, I travel for around 5 hours a day, commuting from Glasgow to Montrose." Jesus. "Always driving, a 250-mile round trip every day." Paul, life is only so long. "Starting around 5:45 in the morning, doesn't finish till 7:30 in the evening. Your podcast gives me a huge deal of joy, gets to the nitty-gritty of most comedians' methods, and is hugely entertaining. I stumbled upon it by accident and have gone through most of your back catalogue. Because of you, I now listen to Jimmy Pardo's Never Not Funny. I did my gardening only yesterday, Paul, in my Jimmy Pardo Never Not Funny hat." Love that guy. "And through him, have discovered Andy Kindler's Thought Spiral and Mark Maron's WTF. You've opened my ears to more comedy I could wish to laugh at. P.S. Barry fucking Cryer." Listen, the episode with Barry was so much fun to record. I was so pleased and honoured and excited to be in his presence. And if you haven't heard it yet, do look out for the bit where I get to tell him my favourite pub joke, the classic beekeeper's joke. So loads to enjoy there, and thank you for everyone that's enjoying that. If you too would like to be like Paul and make yourself feel great by donating to the Comedians Comedian podcast to support the show, you can do that at comedianscomedian.com/donate. Feel free. You can set up a recurring subscription if you'd prefer for just a couple of pounds a month, or you can pick a figure and do us a one-off donation, or go via Moonclerk or any of the other myriad options that are available there. You can no longer buy a discounted t-shirt. By the time you hear this, the pre-sale will have closed. Thank you to everyone. Something like 150 of you have ordered t-shirts in advance, which makes my life much easier administratively, apart from the one massive day where I have to spend all day writing labels and mailing stuff. But I'm quite looking forward to that as well. Bit of time off, isn't it? It's like doing the old tax return. So if you'd like to donate, if you'd like to support the show, comedianscomedian.com, donate. You can join the Facebook group to get intel, yes, intel, on forthcoming guests and our questions and ask questions and so forth. So that will do us for now. Do remember, of course, as if you would forget, that at the Edinburgh Festival this year, you can catch up with an awful lot of previous Comedians Comedian guests. It still staggers me when I meet people who've never been to Edinburgh, particularly if you're in the UK. It's on your doorstep, such a quick flight away, or a lovely long megabus ride, and you can get yourself up there and see literally the biggest arts festival in the world. Of course, your first port of call will be my show at the Liquid Rooms Annex for free, but do bring money. 3:45 every day from the 5th to the 27th. That's called Like I Mean It, and I'll tell you a little bit more about the show itself in the postamble after this episode. But there is an awful lot more. I mean, there's literally over 3,000 other shows to enjoy, so do get yourself up there and get stuck in. That'll do. Let's get back to the fabulous, very funny, very charming Orlando Baxter.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
What kind of a comic are you?
It's a hard way to describe.
I know, I hate asking people this. And I know it infuriates people to be asked this. I hate getting asked this as well. But for people who haven't seen you.
People who've never seen me, I guess I'm a guy that talks mainly about my life and situations that I've been in. I'm not like a guy that kind of... I can talk about a bunch of different things. I don't think I've done it here, as obviously I'm just kind of like doing what my agent's like, oh, just do, make sure you do some of this. But I am a guy that can, when I just let myself go, like the koala thing.
Joke of the night.
Yeah. When I just let myself go, I can be like that, but it all has to be based on something that I went through.
Yeah.
It can't be anything that I haven't experienced. At least not. At least that's how.
It's interesting seeing you after watching Joe DeRosa last night, who's much more a kind of like he takes his own experience and then widens it into some outrageous point of view and argues, here's my topic, here's my thing. And he'll drive a stake in and go, that's the belief, bang, 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 here's the proof, here's the all the rest of it. You're much more a kind of a, so I was doing this. You know, this happened to me.
I
used to be a teacher, that kind of stuff. But the punchlines are no less strong for it.
Yeah.
So you really, it's really interesting because I'm so unfamiliar with, I see a lot of the bigger American comics. I see, you know, people on Netflix and stuff like that. And I see much less American club comedy. So having seen a little bit in the Comedy Store in LA and seen a few gigs around the place, I do have a sense of the different kind of culture of stand-up comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Like something, like biggest example, American comics now, every time I see an American comic do a club set or a short set, everyone comes on, adjusts a stool, puts their phone down on the stool, works, and then while they're working, goes back and keeps checking their phone. Like, I don't know, is that a set list or a timer? Do you know what I mean? That's just like one of those, we try and conceal the moment where we look at our watch.
Yeah. I think Americans, sometimes people are recording.
Yeah. Well, you don't need to look at a recording.
Yeah, no, usually I just put my phone in the pocket.
Yeah, respectful.
I am respectful. I think that's why they keep having me coming back. But that is true, man. Like some, you know, they have this, I don't want to say it's an attitude, but, you know, some people are looking at their sets. Some people, they got a new bit that they're trying to, I don't know why they do it, but I think they, during the clubs, and it's a shorter set, I think sometimes people are working on shit or they're not treating it the same way. You won't see that in a normal, just like a club show, because the showcase shows are a lot different, obviously, than the regular show. Like I do more regular shows than showcase shows. Like,
describe the difference to me in those terms.
Showcase show would be there's 6 or 7, 8 comics on one night, and they're all doing between 15 to 20 minutes. Where a regular show to me, like when you normally do a club, say you were working a weekend somewhere in Boston or wherever, you know, you'd have the opener who does 15, the middler that does 20 to 25, and then the headliner We'll do 45 to an hour. And nobody is going up there, like, kind of like looking at, maybe the first guy might in terms of that. But, like, I think that's more of a showcase type.
Sure. Okay. Because it is, it's interesting you use the word attitude, because to me, it does establish an attitude, not necessarily in a negative way. It establishes like a real superiority of status. Yeah. Like, well, you guys are lucky to be listening to me try whatever I want. You know, I can't help but do that. And I think that's really interesting. I've seen a lot of different types of comics all employ, you know, employ that idea. Or maybe it's not even a deliberate thing. Maybe it's just, maybe it's symptomatic of their actual attitude. What do you think? Is it like a deliberate, is that supposed to be read by an audience as, I'm just working out some stuff? Because I know, I mean, as I understand it, the American, the system, the economics of being a comic in America are that you really only can make a living when you're a headliner.
Yes.
Are you a headliner?
Yeah, I do headline.
Okay. You do headline.
I do headline. It is.
You have headline, but you're...
I'm a headliner. I usually headline. I just don't... But I think in the States, the biggest difference is, you know, unless you're a national headliner.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And then
you, that means you get booked and you draw your crowd.
Well, it just basically means you put asses in seats.
Exactly.
Because you can be, you can really not be a headliner, but you put asses in seats and be able to headline.
Yeah.
You understand what I mean?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Because it's all about, at the end of the day, it's all about the dough.
How are you for asses?
I'm horrible. No asses. I'm trying to get asses in seats.
Yeah, so, yeah. That's what.
So I'm working. I'm working. Like, I think sometimes the credits that you have opens the door as far as, like, getting you in a lot more clubs. So, like, the credits that I have, like the Conan credit and some of the other things I've done, it gets me in the door with some of the national clubs, but not as many as I would. They're like, it's kind of like, all right, you can be on the bench. You can be on the team, but you're on the bench. You're not going to play like the regular guys.
And is that frustrating?
That's very frustrating. Well,
especially if you're seeing someone who's like, I don't know what. Hey, this is a side note. Have YouTubers started to...
Yes.
YouTubers can put asses on seats, right?
Yes.
They can't necessarily do the job.
Yes.
So is that happening now?
That's been happening, and it's difficult. Watch.
Because that doesn't work under the UK system.
No.
You might get a YouTuber doing their tour show on a Thursday night, or, you know, taking over the whole venue and selling it out and everything. I mean, maybe our system is at risk from that kind of thing, but you'll never get a YouTuber close a club unless they can demonstrably close a club.
Well, that's a good thing. In the States, that doesn't hold the same way. The YouTubers that get into stand-up comedy, and they're probably, most of them, the ones that I've seen, there's a couple that are good, a couple that are really good and deserve to headline, but then there's some that I see and I'm like, how? You know? But that's just the way the system is. So it makes it very difficult for dudes that go on the road and headline, and, you know, we struggle to get into some of the clubs.
It's fascinating to just, I try to put myself in the position of a YouTuber who is almost, I'm not going to use the word parasite, but they're the new kind of, you know, they're the, what's a good, there's like an animal analogy. We're in Australia, they're the cane toads. Yeah. You know what I mean? They're arriving, they're taking everything over. From the perspective of that, what do they think of us, the guys driving up and down the country? Presumably they think, who are these, why are these dinosaurs? Why would you waste all that time traveling on a freeway, going up and down, flying from one gig to another, when you can just knock out a lot of stuff in your bedroom?
Yes. I think it's like kind of like a double-edged sword. Like, it depends on how they do it. Like, in terms of, if you get a YouTuber to headline a show, as long as he brings his own opener, it's helpful. Because if he goes and does a show and he has a guy like me featuring in front of him, and I'm doing 20 to 25 of heat, then it's going to be, he's going to struggle. But that's for headliners as well. Because obviously I don't headline everywhere, because, you know, around my area, around Boston or around New England in general, I headline at all the clubs. But in the Midwest, I don't, or other places, you know, I'm still trying to get into some of these clubs as headliners. But when I do these shows, or like when they say, hey, well, why don't you come out and feature for us so we can check you out? So they put me in front of a headliner. And all I'm saying is, have your shit together.
Yeah, right.
It could be a long night if I'm going. You know what I mean? But
I don't know what you mean. Be you more don't. Specific about what you mean. What I think you're implying,
I'm
is
implying
that you're going to go as hard as possible and try to make it hard for the headliners.
I'm not even saying it like that. I'm just saying that I think now, I don't go in with that attitude. I just think that, you know, some people are really good. Like, I'm not saying I'm really good, but I'm good enough to where you have to be good. Just for I guess that's the best way to say it. You know what I mean? Like, I'm good enough at the feature job to where somebody that's headlining might say, you're not a feature.
Yeah, right, exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, you don't want to make life hard for them. I say that kind of playfully, like, you want to make it hard for them. But actually, yeah, you do want them, you want the headliner to go to have a word with the promoter and go, this guy's a headliner.
Yeah, but it's just, it's not, I'm not trying to. I think most comics, or the comics that I know, I know there's guys that come out and try to bury the guy that's going to follow them. I don't have that attitude. I'm just kind of doing what I do, and consistently doing what I do okay. So if you're a guy that is a headliner, but you're not that strong, it's going to be tough. It's not going to be easy. It's not that I'm trying to bury you. I'm just doing my job.
Does that ever have a downside if the headliner... Have you ever been in a situation... I'm just as a thought experiment here. If there's a headliner who you know can put asses on seats but doesn't have the skills that you've got, then do you ever have to think to yourself, I better temper this because I'm going to piss this guy off and I'm not going to get booked again by the club? Does that ever come into the equation? It's just so different from our system. I'm just
for me, not really. Like, for me, I just do what I do. Like, I try to be respectful, you know, in terms of, like, because some headliners would be like, hey, man, can you not use any profanity? Or, hey, man, can you not talk about this or that topic?
Because profanity, because it would offend them, or because they're
no,
they
not
want
because
to of, use all those
yeah, they want to use
no, wait. Well, I know this. Can like, the first act, don't do any crowd work.
Don't do
because
any
you've
got
to leave the crowd work for the headline. That is unthinkable to British audiences.
Yes, yes. So all of that, you factor in. So I'm respectful in that form. But usually headliners won't say that to the feature so much, but they will for the opener. You know, kind of like, you know, because, you know, opener. And I get that, though. I get the mentality because if you being the first comic sometimes, which is a very difficult job, you kind of set the tone for the audience. So if you're going back and forth and the audience is thinking, oh, it's OK for me to yell shit out and do this, that and the other. And that carries over to the feature act. Then the headline is the one who's dealing with them at their drunkest, at their most tired. Like, it's not like the UK. The thing that I loved about the UK that completely shocked me was the intermissions.
Yeah, close.
That blew me away. I'm like, why are we doing this? Because I just had no idea. And then people came back and it was like, you're starting the engine.
Yeah,
back
yeah.
Up again.
And it means we don't have a check drop.
No check drop.
No check drop. That would drive me nuts if I was headlining in the US and during the bit of my material, which is like, oh, I've really been working to gather all this momentum, suddenly people are legitimately having loud conversations all over the room. It's insane.
Yeah, it is. But you know, I'm so used to it.
Yeah, of course.
Like, because you know, all right, you can just tell. You don't beat yourself up. At first,
yeah,
you're beating yourself
so
up.
So you've got check drop stuff. You've got check drop material.
I just don't. I guess I ignore it at some point. Like, so I know, like, oh, okay, their heads are down.
Yeah.
They're looking at this check, you know, and I don't even have the material. I just kind of like, I don't know. I just kind of get
through. Be less needy.
Yeah. I'm not going to do my big joke when I know that the check is going to drop.
Sure.
You know what I mean? It's just more like I might do crowd work during that time, just whatever. But you just adjust to it. And I think that, you know, a lot of times, I remember when I was a feature, mainly featuring, and I was like, man, I want to be a headliner. And this older headlining comic out in Boston says to me, you'll know you're a headliner when you can bomb for 45 minutes. I was like, what? I was like, what do you mean? He's like, yeah, man, because if you can bomb for the whole time frame, that means you can do the time. Because if you have good 45, right, and then say you do have a crowd that it doesn't go well, that 45 might turn into 30.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a lot of stuff you learn. It's not necessary. And to me, I'm always like, It's not about the time. A lot of people think it's about the time. I think you think about the time when you think, oh man, I got to do 45 minutes to an hour. And you think about the time, but it's really not about the time. I just think that you have to have the ability to close out the show. And some people can close and some people can't.
Put a pin in what those abilities are to close. What kind of things are you talking about? I mean, I totally agree with you, but I want to hear what your idea of those attributes look like.
It's kind of hard to describe. You just got to be able to carry. The best way I can put it is, I know you guys, I don't know if they're familiar with baseball analogies, but there's different types.
We could struggle, but we'll try.
Let's try to struggle. Okay. There's different types of pitchers, guys who throw the ball at the batters. And there's guys that start the game and they're awesome pitchers and they'll pitch for, baseball is usually 9 innings. So they'll pitch for like 6 innings, right? And then they'll bring in some middler, like they're called middler pitches, right? They come in the middle and they'll do 1 or 2 innings. And then at the end of the game, there's a closer, right? They only pitch in 1 inning, maybe more if it gets extended. But it takes a certain type of attitude to come in and be able to close out a game. And I think that, you know, when you're a headliner, at least in the States, at least that what I feel like, you know, a show has to go a certain way. It can't go up and down. And a lot of times, even though that middle spot is the ideal spot, it's the best spot. It's the easy spot. You're not starting the show, getting the cushy spot. You're only doing like 20, 25 minutes. The headliner has to close the deal. They got to seal the deal. So what qualities I think they would have, they just have to have the ability to control a crowd with laughter through, you know, while they're drunk, while they're tired, and make the people leave feeling like this was a good show. The show went the way it was supposed to go. You don't want it to be where the middle guys like destroying. Like they said, Dane Cook, when he was in Boston, and like I said, in New England, there's all these big Boston headliners. And Dane Cook, when he was featuring, would come to these shows and destroy the shows. He was that, like, to the point where nobody wanted to work with him because he was that good. And I think when you get to that point, that's when you know you should be closing out a show.
Yeah.
So I guess that's the big thing. When you get to the point where you're giving every headline a hard time, you deserve to be.
I think it's something about authority as well. You can tell a closer, there's a certain type of closer. Mm-hmm. Like I remember the first time I ever saw a headliner come on stage and take a stool and sit down. And I was like, oh, like I sat forward in my chair. Oh, this guy, what was I thinking? Again, it's like, it's in a different way to the looking at the phone thing, but it's like a subtle, it's an intangible kind of a, oh, this is different. This guy, he's happy sitting down.
Yes.
Is he just old? No, it's authority, right? There's some kind of, like a closer pitcher. Okay, that's an interesting way of putting it.
Yeah. Well, except obviously when you're headlining, you're not doing one inning. You're doing a ton. You're doing the majority of the work.
Sure.
The bulk of the work. But yeah, man. But back to the, you made a point about the YouTubers. And I just wanted to say this. The hard part for the YouTubers is if they don't bring their own guy in front of them that they can kind of follow, then it's an issue. You know what I mean?
Yeah, because there'll be a club feature.
Yes.
Who's good and attuned to a club, and then a YouTuber who has a huge following and is probably good at attracting a huge following on YouTube, but does not necessarily have gears, material.
It's happened a bunch of times. And this doesn't even go for YouTubers. This can be celebrities that they have the name and they have the they can put asses in the seats. They got the asses.
The show notes for this episode are going to be me and Orlando Banks to discuss asses.
Asses. And, but they, you know, they get mopped up, man. They struggle. I've seen it happen. I've done shows where there are certain people that close out the show and people just walk out, you know, because you're there for a long time. That's what I love about comedy. You can't hide. I don't care how many assets you put in seats. If you're doing 45 minutes, you can't hide if you put somebody up that's really strong in front of you. There's no hiding. So, yeah, you're getting the money, but you got to deal with that fucking embarrassment.
So do the YouTubers bring, like, tissue soft features?
They should, if they're smart. I don't think they do because I think that some of them, you know, it's ego. Like, I work with somebody who said after the show, after about 20 people walked out on this particular person, and after the show, he's like, man, you had a good set, man, but that wasn't my crowd tonight, right? Mm-hmm. That's what he said the first night, second night, third. Like, they just, I think sometimes when you're a celebrity, you're like kind of like oblivious to the reality.
Yeah, I think that's almost a necessary attribute to become a celebrity. Is you have to be able to look reality in the eye and go, no, I deserve more than this. Do you know what I mean? That's all the people. No, I wouldn't say all the people, but I certainly know people who are, you know, Tom Stade, brilliant comic. I don't know if you saw Tom Stade when you were in Edinburgh. Fantastic comic. He said on this podcast, if you want to be a star, fucking act like one.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people who are doing that half of the equation.
Yes. You know? Yes.
So let's bring it back to you and your process.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess this, your material, the two sections that I saw on the Conan thing that people can see, yeah, online, mm-hmm, you've got the encounter in the shop with the black people using sunblock.
Yes.
And I was watching that. I mean, I'd seen you before at Setlist. I'd seen the video stuff. And it was the word ability. Excuse me, ability? That,
yes.
I mean, that went, oh, yeah, of course I'm going to get a land on the show. So that's a very well-written bit. And I guess it's kind of a showcase. But a showcase in the sense of, like, that's what your manager would say, you should do that in Melbourne, you should do,
yes,
that on Conan.
Yes.
That's like a bit. So is that a bit that you, and we can talk about that because anyone listening to this who cares to do so can watch that online. Is how long have you had that bit for? How long have you been refining that bit?
That one hasn't been too long. Maybe.
I'm not trying to catch you out. No, 20 years.
No, I'm trying to think. 2 years maybe?
Okay.
About two years. Like, for me to, like, really get it. Because what will happen with me is I really don't write. Like, I kind of, like, the whole, like, the koala thing. Like, as soon as I find something, I'll keep playing with it on stage. And then I'll remember more details. And then
I feel we've mentioned the koala thing twice. Do you want to just butcher it a bit for us so people know what we're talking about?
It's
a facial expression. It's not going to work.
It's not going to work. I'll talk about that bit. So when it happened, when the lady said what she said, if you listen to the bit, I remember being on stage and kind of saying it. And I got a laugh on one of the parts. I got a laugh right on the beginning because it's not what I said to her, but it's what I thought. Like that, the first punchline that I say when she said, "For what?" You know, I said what I was thinking. So what will happen with me is I'll start thinking about the experience and be like, "Damn, what would I have? What should I really have said? And then how would this have conversation would have went?" And then I'll just keep continuing it until it makes sense to me. Until I kind of just figure out. So everything is based on a real experience, and then I kind of form it on stage. Like, I just keep talking about it.
And how has that process come about? Have you tried other things? Have you tried sitting down and writing out longhand?
I have.
The beats of it?
I started like that. I started like that, and I didn't like, and maybe I should go back to it, because I think you write way more than the way that I'm inspired by experiences.
You wait to be inspired.
I do, or I just do things, and I just talk about whatever I'm doing, and then I just wait for that shit to get good.
But you're on the Edinburgh train now. You've got to turn over an hour a year.
I know.
Unlike most American comics.
Yes, that
you've
just
made the deal with the devil.
I was so blown away and just, like, impressed by Edinburgh. Like, it just blew me away that people were writing a new hour every year. Just like, what the hell is
Well, good for you, because I've had American acts on this who've said, why do you do that? It's ridiculous. How do you ever get good gear? And that's a valid,
Stuff I'm bemoaning at this festival. I'm like, oh god, that bit that I've been doing for the last 70 shows that I'm now doing in the show here, which the show, I take this show back to the UK, I do 15 more tour dates and then it's over.
Yeah.
And there's a bit in it now that's really starting to really morph and come into its own. And I'm like, Edinburgh as a festival won't let me take that bit back next year and work on it.
Yes.
It's infuriating.
Yeah. And that's the downside of it, I guess. But I am impressed with the shows that I've seen and seeing people do an hour. And I'm like, you did all this within a year. That's very impressive to me. You know, I guess some Americans are like, is it good? I'm like, dude, it's good. But they can say that if they've never been here to see the types of acts. You know, you can easily talk shit when you're never going to go there. And you're just going to have this general assumption of what else is out there outside of America. But I've seen some phenomenal acts. And I think even the storytelling form, because people, you got to have this theme and this arc. And I'm like, yeah, but it's funny. The shit is funny. Like, you can't deny funny.
Yeah.
You know? So I'm really impressed with it. It's something that I want to do again. I don't think I'll be able to write another hour in a year's time. But I think it's a little harder to do that format in America, in a sense. Because of the club set, the opener, middler, headliner kind of mentality, and then they want to hear the jokes right away. Like, they're not as open to you fucking this theme or this arc. But I will say this: when I came back to America after doing Edinburgh, and I decided to do a couple shows and add in some of the arcs that I never would have added in before that, they loved them.
Something I've noticed in UK comedy is that we are starting, now that there's so much American stuff available to us, Netflix, Spotify, yes, online, iTunes, whatever, and also because I think people have been going up and doing themed narrative arc shows for years and years and years, we're almost starting to go, no, I'm going to do a more American-style show. I'm just going to turn up, funny, 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 funny. Bits of the material can exist in any order. Forget the callbacks. Just do the bit. Funny 10, funny 10, funny 10 in any order. And then at any point where I get a round of applause, good night. that seems to me to be the American club set way of doing it. You build up to a thing until it's inescapable. They all start clapping. And then you're like, and that turned out to be the end. I've made the decision now. I'm out.
Yes, that is. That's very American right there.
It's really interesting to hear that it's happening the other way around, that, you know, we're cross-pollinating. Taking the idea of arcs back to America.
No, definitely for me it's been very helpful, because it just made me think in a way that I wasn't thinking before. And like I said, even with those the audiences, it's a lot more conservative. So like, going back home is funny, because it's like, you know, America's, they fucking laugh. Like, there was one point when I was in Edinburgh, I might have been there for about 20 days. And, you know, I was watching some show, and, you know, I'm in the crowd and I'm watching whoever performing. And then I heard this loud laughter, and I just turned around. And I was like, Americans. I've been changed by this festival. I realized we laugh a lot easier, and we just laugh at almost anything. So coming back home, it almost felt easier.
Yeah, right.
To be honest with you.
It's a good way around to have it. Yeah. You know, I'll go to America, I'll go, God, they're all polite here. They're big laughers. This is so great. Go back to the UK. All right.
Yeah.
Now I'm back to hecklers and all that kind of shit.
Oh, yeah. And then London's a different ball game as well, because I didn't realize. I went to some Piccadilly Club, comedy club.
Yeah,
there's
a Piccadilly comedy club. And, Soho comedy club in Piccadilly. There's a comedy.
Yeah, there was I forgot where I went, but it was fucking rowdy, man. It was like stag parties, and I just was like, what the fuck is this? They just going ape shit. But it was cool. It was cool. Like, I was like, all right, I've done shows like with it.
Yeah, and presumably, I mean, you've got gear, you've got like put downs, you've got your own kind of stuff.
You just gotta
you just don't use that so often in America, because people tend to be more polite.
Well, no, I don't think it depends on what kind of crowd you're in front of. I've taken my share of fucking shots to the face.
Quick, man. Play Rawhide.
It just fucking, like, to me, I think some of the, I don't know if this is racist, but I think some of the audiences, some of the more urban audiences, the more diverse.
Are you a black man using the word urban?
Yes,
who subtly implied black people?
Yes. black. I'm saying urban. I'm saying urban more because it's just a little. It's just a little more. It can be difficult. They can be not from. I'm just speaking in general. They're not as easy. You got to be funny. If you're not funny, they will let you know you're not funny. And I've done shows where one time I did a show, I it was horrible. Like it was this, I was in this room and it was this bar, a black bar in Roxbury in Boston. And it was like a guy on the wall. And, you know, I made this comment about the guy on the wall. And I didn't realize the guy had died. And
okay.
It was like, and it was just fucking downhill after that.
Who's this douchebag you bought putting a framed photo of on the wall?
Yeah. it was just like, this is very, fucking tough. Like, people know about this room. And everything is just dying. And then, so I get nothing. But the good thing is, it wasn't even like, they didn't boo me or heckle me. They just talk. Like, you can,
yeah.
It was like I wasn't there. I didn't exist. And then I get off the stage and the host, this guy named Jonathan Gates, very funny comic out of Boston. He just looks at me and he looks at his watch and he looks at his phone and he looks at me and he's trying to settle the crowd down. And he's like, man, I have never received so many texts in my life saying, get this motherfucker off the stage. I'm sitting in the corner like, Jesus Christ. But I went back a month later and I redeemed myself and I've never been back since. That was about
I'm
8
done.
Years ago. Yeah. I was done.
I'm done. We quit.
Yeah, man. But to me, internationally, I've been learning so much about myself, just watching other comedians, as well as just understanding that culturally, no matter where you go, there are certain things that are important to people, and then there's certain things that are not. And you finding out and knowing kind of the difference between what is important and what's not can be helpful in terms of material.
Yes, and I think that is, I think that's like the junior level of that is turning up at the club and going, so what's the area around here where people X, Y, Z? But the senior, the elite level of that, mm-hmm. is about exactly as you say, knowing what's important to people in the audience. One of my comedy heroes, and a lot of people's, I mean, he's a very well known comic in the UK, got banned from a lot of clubs in the 80s, a guy called Ian Cognito. He's mm-hmm. a fantastic comic. Mm-hmm. Look forward to getting him on the show. His opening line used to be, apologies Ian, I may butcher this in the delivery, but his opening line used to be, my name's Ian Cognito and I'm not the best comedian you're ever going to see, but I am the best in my price range. And that to me is just a perfect A1 diamond grade opening line, because not only does it not only is it boasting and self-deprecating, yeah. not only is it a really functional joke that just works structurally beautiful, what it says is it contains that understanding of what's important to everyone in the room. Like, we'll, you know, rather than coming on and going, I look like this, my hair's like this, these are all my issues, just that my price range, everyone's like, oh, we've all got it, everyone knows where we are in their thing. And I think that's that is a really that gives a room incredible confidence, I mm-hmm. think, in an act, if they get that you get what they get.
Yeah.
So what aspects of your own performance are you looking to improve on? Or what things are there? What things are there? Because I always like it when I meet comics who go and see other shows, because I know a lot of comics go to a festival, do their shows, get drunk, hang out. I run around the place seeing as many shows as I can. What things have you seen here or in Edinburgh where you've thought, that... I don't know if I'll ever do that, or I don't know if I'll maybe that could be useful to me, those kind of quotes.
I think the writing aspect to it, man, like I just seen a lot of really good comics that just made me think like, oh, I gotta write more, or there's a story here, or like, cause sometimes like I think in America well, at least for me, I mean, not even say I think in America, like you get the jokes and you get the laugh and then you kind of you don't continue to dig deeper. And I've seen a couple comics where I'm like, I could do a little bit more with this bit that I'm doing.
Who in particular has inspired you along those lines?
I've seen, now you're putting me to the test. I've seen, you know, really, I've seen Sarah, what's her last name? Sarah Kendall.
Pascal, Kendall.
I've seen Sarah Kendall.
Big ginger hair.
Yeah, and I I really love their show. I seen guys like, let's see, there's a guy that I seen in London. Damn, I forgot his name. Nigerian guy.
Fumbi?
Oba. Wait, what's his name?
Oh, it's Prince Abdi, Somalian guy.
No, this guy's from, he's from, I know him because I know his cousin. His cousin actually lives in the same city as me. I just forget, my mind is blank right now. Such a good writer. Like, unbelievable writer. Damn, I got, it's like Oba. Oma. I seen him at Top Secret.
Ola. Ola the comedian. Yes.
Love Ola.
It's fantastic. Right?
Love Ola. I seen, this sounds a weird, I'm naming like all the black comics. And I like Dane Baptiste. I seen him the first year when I went to Edinburgh. I forgot her name. I'm bad with names, man. I have the worst memory in the world. But there's guys that I just see where I watch and I just listen to the material and I'm like, oh, I could put more into it. Like, just don't go just for, you know, I do a lot of personal stuff. So sometimes I'm like, oh, I could dig deeper. Or I think for me, I got to start. There's a lot of dark stuff that I have that I kind of don't touch on because I'm thinking, people are not going to really get it. They're not from here. But I did a joke last night that was kind of like darker.
Which one? Because I saw last night. Which?
Were you there when I said about my father? Did I do that last night?
I don't know if you did. What was the line?
That I was talking about how I met my father when I was...
Yes, yeah, oh Christ, yeah, the BMX bike.
Yes, that's true.
That's true.
That's not even a joke, but that's what I mean. I don't write jokes. Like, I'll write jokes based off...
Yeah.
But I'll form it. I mean, obviously, I'll exaggerate.
Sure.
But it's based
on... Was he the guy in the handlebars?
He was the guy.
Oh, man. Just, I mean, I feel we've got, if you don't mind, it's not going to burn the bit to put it on here. People are going to enjoy coming to see it when they see you.
Yes.
So you're talking about meeting your real father.
For the first time, and I turn around.
And you're 10 years old.
Yeah, I'm 10 years old, and I've never met him. I heard about him. I never met him. And then, obviously you hear about him, but I never seen him, never met him. And I turn around, and I hear somebody calling my name, and there's these two black guys approaching me on one bicycle. And then, you know, one guy's pedaling the bike, the other guy's on the handlebars of the bike. And the obviously, the joke, it's not even really a joke. It's true. Like, because in my mind, I was like, oh, when I meet my father, things are going to change around. Da, 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 da. And, you know, I just envisioned in my head that he was going to be this rich guy. And then when you see everything change in that situation. And I don't want to kill the bit.
Because
there's more to the bit. It's just when I was doing it last night, I kind of just did it in a way. Just did it in a different way. But there's more into it. It's insanity. My life is really crazy. Has been really crazy. And sometimes I just get, I was going to write my second Edinburgh thing just based on kind of how I grew up. But then I just kind of was like, I need to just chill.
Why do you need to just chill? That sounds like an incredible wealth of information.
I know. And my agent was just kind of telling me like, you could write about this and you could write about that. And then I just was kind of like, I don't think I was in the, I think you got to be in a place to do that. Like,
yeah.
When the material is dark sometimes and it's personal sometimes and it's still like, impacts you sometimes.
Yep.
You got to be okay with putting it out to the public.
Absolutely.
And I feel like there's certain pieces I'm able to pull out and talk about to the public. But if I need to go deeper, you know, it's not like I haven't worked. And that's the thing I was saying about just going deeper with some of the material, because there's a lot of stuff about my life that people just be like, I just tell about the good part. So, hey, I was a teacher. I was a bad one, but I was I was one. But, you know, my agent's always like, you got so many more interesting areas in your life that you need to kind of
push. That is a real challenge for a comedian. If you have those things to talk about, and those could be I the analogy I would use here is I remember doing a yoga class years ago where someone actually said a thing I will always remember, which is it's about bending over, and you know, you're standing, you're bending over, touch your toes, and it's, they just said, just roll up, let every vertebrae in your spine, you just feel them all, and the ones where you want to skip it, those are the ones you need to be working on. The ones where you want to go, I'm rolling up, 1, 2, 3, I'll just do 4, 5, 6.
Yeah.
That's the stuff. Now, maybe that's true of comedy as well. The stuff that you're shying away from,
yeah,
maybe that's the stuff that is going to become your most powerful stuff, your most meaningful stuff.
Yeah.
And that's interesting that you recognize that, but equally, you know, if you haven't resolved that stuff for yourself, maybe the best, maybe the most useful thing for your life and yeah, your soul exactly. is not to milk it all like, for love. Yeah,
great show. I'm going to go kill myself.
Was that what you're worried about? You're worried about turning your audience off, or you're worried about upsetting yourself?
It's a combination of both. It's a combination of, I think sometimes when you're just getting older, you become more comfortable with yourself. And the same thing when you're on stage, you become comfortable with yourself on stage and the material that you're delivering. And I think the deeper you go sometimes, because I think a lot of people are, some people are telling very deep and personal things, and those are the guys that I kind of like. I like, like I like the Doug Stanhopes, and you know, he's from my city, like his dad was a teacher in my city. Okay. He's from there, yeah. So like guys like that, and so I look at those guys and I'm always like, oh, I want to kind of like push and talk.
Tell me if you don't want to talk any further about that kind of stuff. I suppose I'm interested in exactly what you talk about when you mean the darker stuff in your life. I don't want to pry.
Yeah, no,
I'm
just
interested
saying,
in the how the guy who went through whatever it is deals with being a comedian because of or in spite of that, or what sort of sphere are we talking about?
I think that sometimes it's just a fear of wanting or letting the public know everything about you. You know what I mean? Like, you want to keep some things to yourself, because I am a comedian, meaning like I don't need to talk about all my personal stuff to be funny. I think Chris Rock doesn't talk much about his personal life and he's still funny as hell, and there are plenty of comics like that. But because I do have a tendency to talk about my experiences, I lean towards that side of it a little bit more, but like some of the more of the lighter side. Not, I don't get real dark, but there are bits that I have that are a lot darker that I'll do once in a while. Like I do it when I'm bombing, when I don't care.
time for a bombing.
Yeah, yeah. When I've completely given up, I'll go real. I'll get nasty, not nasty, but just real. Like, all right, this happened. And people are kind of like, oh my God, was that, did you make that up? And I'm like, and unfortunately.
So no. Given that this is stuff, do you mind telling us what sort of thing you're talking about?
I mean, like I said, I grew up very, very rough. My whole father's situation was difficult. My mother's situation was, you know, she was on substance. She had a drug problem, bad drug problem. And, you know, so I dealt with a lot of crazy, crazy shit growing up. And dealings with people in that life, you know, the crackheads, and this like stories about them and stories about, you know, and I don't mind telling this part of it because my mother's fine now, and you know, she's been sober for 20 something odd years, and she's doing very well. But just how I grew up real difficult, and that's the best way that I could say it. And sometimes it's funny when I like meet, having these wars with, I would have wars with people that were on drugs, in terms of like, you know, cause they would, you know, knocking on my door, trying to like, hey, you know, get my mother to leave. And I would do all these things, man. Like I would have these fights and these things where I would, cause I didn't want them to be at my house, and I had younger brothers and I was always trying to protect my younger brothers. So I would have these like battles, and when I look back on them, it was fucked up, but when I look back on them, I see the funny in it. But it's, do I want to put it out? Like, do I want to rehash these old feelings that don't exist anymore, because my life isn't like that? It's like so far different from what it is now, you know. Like even the stuff about my father, like I found out when I was in Edinburgh, I found out I have a sister.
Holy
shit.
Dude, I have insane, like, my life is real crazy. So it's me getting to a place where I feel comfortable talking about all that.
And do you aspire to that? Do you want to get to a
yes,
place?
Yes, I do.
I do.
I think that, you know, I think that eventually I will get there. But and I think like festivals like this are very helpful in terms of, because in the UK or at Edinburgh and even here, it's, everybody's talking about personal stuff. And it's like this theme. And that's real inspiring to me. And maybe that's one of the reasons why I'm so fascinated by it. And I'm just kind of like, she just did a whole like routine about one day in her life where you don't see that in the States. So for me personally, and for my own journey as a comedian and just as somebody that's been through a lot in my life, that's inspiring to me.
Moth to a flame. I mean, maybe that's why you came to Edinburgh in the first case. If you something you gleaned from Hannibal going, oh, everyone does these shows like that. Do you think there's some element where you're like, oh, I want to be able to talk about that stuff?
Yeah, there is a part of me, because when I came here, I obviously didn't know what to expect. I just knew it was going to be a lot of shows. There's going to be a lot of comics. I wanted to see what it was like. And my only experience, international experience prior to that, was being on like these, it was like a little showcase competition. So I had no idea about the long hour show. So to see, like, you know, to hear Sarah Kendall tell this story about this death of her friend and to bring, but to me, that was just, it kind of blew me away. And I think that's probably what excited my Mick Perrin and everybody, because when we went out to lunch and we started talking about things, and I was talking about my life, I don't mind telling people like on a personal level, but to put it out there publicly is completely different.
Yeah. And so you, yeah, that's interesting. You would say, okay, from a producer promoter point of view, oh, maybe that's part of the package.
Yeah, that is
like, Orlando, when you're ready, we can sell this. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, you know, that's an area, like, to go back to your question, that's an area that I definitely need to write more personal things. But it's like, you know, I'm in this place too where I'm still trying to get on as an American comic, you know. It's weird. I say this all the time. I probably know more UK comics that are doing very well, or just comics from outside of the US that are doing very well, as opposed to inside the U.S. I know a ton of comics, but I don't know them. You know, the few that I do know.
Yeah, because you meet them for a weekend here and there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's like a different... And I'm trying to break big in the U.S. as well. So what I have is working. So sometimes when you have something that's working and you're trying to see where it takes you, it puts a lot of other things on the back.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? If this were a movie... This interview were a movie, this would be the bit where I go, but don't you see, Orlando? It's the death, you know what I mean? That stuff, that's what's going to make you break anything everywhere.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's real life, and maybe you start writing stuff about your darker past, and maybe you do experience a 3-year bump in the States when people are like, no, we didn't want to hear this stuff. And maybe then you soar out of that like a phoenix and become huge, and maybe you don't.
Maybe.
So yeah, it's real life, right?
It's what real life. Maybe not. It's not a movie, man. So yeah, so that's you know, so that's like a struggle that I have. But like I said, every time I go overseas, I feel like I'm inspired again, just because I'm seeing people doing these one man shows, which don't really exist like that in the States. Everything is like kind of a bunch of material put together with a big closer at the end.
I wonder about the difference in kind of. Something, I can't remember where I heard this, but it keeps coming into mind, I've mentioned it a few times on the podcast, is that a comedian is simultaneously the most powerful and the most vulnerable person in the room.
Yeah.
I can't remember who said it, no apologies for using it without attribution. If someone reminds me, I'll start crediting whoever it is every time. But it seems to me like the US style, the spots, 5 tens, bang, 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 got to get paid, got to get the laughs, got all that kind of stuff. That seems to lend itself, as does the UK club circuit. So say the clubs, be they US, UK. Those prize power.
Mm-hmm.
Power, being the most powerful person in the room, is the most important thing. Something that really is prized greatly at festivals is being the most vulnerable person.
Yes.
You know, and being prepared to go there. That's what, when awards nominations come out year after year, they're not designed to...
point the man in the street to the most appropriate comedy show for them.
Yes.
I was talking to a local comedian, local to Melbourne, a comedian called Dave Thornton last night about this. And we were saying, you know, the awards don't exist as a means of highlighting the most suitable shows for the majority of the comedy-going public. The awards seem to serve the people who choose the awards, and it's almost like they're saying these are the best shows for if you've seen as much comedy as we have. Mm-hmm. These are the most refreshing shows. These are the most inventive or innovative shows. And I say that completely without prejudice. I mean, mm-hmm. it's an entirely valid thing. But so what they love is people being vulnerable.
Yeah.
And that necessarily isn't what works in clubs and therein lies.
Yes. That's very difficult, you know? So, I mean, I agree. Like, I remember trying to, before I came to Edinburgh, and just being in the U.S. and being like, oh, man, I got to find some time to work on this set, this hour set. And I remember trying it at the club. And I was like, wah, wah. I was like, I can't. I got to do it in, like, kind of, like, spots, like, certain spots. Because it's difficult to do in the clubs.
Yeah.
The club scene is different, man. You have some feature act comes up, and they're, like, fucking hammering jokes home for 25 minutes. And now you want me to come up and tell this story on this one topic. It's hard, you know. So that's.
But if you do that, you're going to be the only guy in America doing that, are you? Or you're going to be, you know what I mean? Nail that.
Yeah.
That headliner, that closer.
Yeah.
He just talked about one thing.
Yes. I think it would be good, but see, and this is where I think it could benefit me. It could benefit me, like on something like your own special.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, because you're not, you don't have that extra pressure of the other comics coming before you. And even if you do that time, you can, it seems like it's better. Like, people are more impressed. Like, oh, okay, this isn't stand-up, but it's still funny. And it's kind of stand-up, but there's a theme involved with it. And I think that's where it becomes beneficial. Like, so, it, you know, and that's what I'm trying to shoot for myself. Get me a Netflix special. Doing half-an-hour specials now. I don't know if you know this.
Netflix is doing half hours.
I think so.
Yeah. Oh, it's a game changer.
I heard it. Yeah, that's a game changer for a lot of comics, man.
That's the territory of tomorrow, isn't it? Netflix. Like, you could. That's almost like YouTube plus road miles.
Yeah.
Netflix. Do you know what I mean? Get the road miles, do a good job, yeah. Put it on Netflix, put it in people's homes, and that's how we can keep the YouTubers out.
Yes, yes.
To have that kind of profile. Is that what everyone in the States is looking for at the moment now?
Yeah,
everyone wants a Netflix.
Everything in the States is all Netflix. I mean, I think everything else, the Comedy Central, half an hour, and it doesn't hold the same weight anymore. I don't think some of the cable networks, the HBOs and Showtimes, I don't think they hold as much. I could be wrong, but...
And Netflix will never release the numbers. So no one knows how many people saw their show on Netflix.
Exactly. So, but I just think that I've seen what it has personally done, and I've heard a comedian friend of mine, as well as just heard other comics on podcasts and the impact Netflix has had on them in terms of going from doing comedy clubs to doing strictly theaters, which is huge. It's a game changer.
Which other comedian would it be most narratively satisfying if they killed you?
What comedian would be if they killed me? Chris Rock. I would say Chris Rock, man. That's my guy. If anybody's gonna kill me, let it be him.
What would you have engraved on your comedy gravestone?
It all worked out in the end, I guess. It all worked out in the end. Just because my life was kind of crazy, and now, like, it's getting a lot better than what it was in the beginning. So it all worked out in the end.
Let's leave it there. Thanks, man.
All right, brother.
So that was Orlando. Thank you for listening to that. Thank you very much, everyone in Melbourne who looked after me. It's always nice to listen back to these older episodes and remember the lovely time we had at that festival. I do hope to return next year. We'll see about that. That would be an awful lot of fun. More coming up from Melbourne soon. We've got Ivan Aristegueta, we've got Anne Edmonds, Nick Cody, and a couple of other bits and bobs besides. Next week, I'm fairly certain I'm going to bring you Simon Munnery. Now, if you're a com completist, you will probably have gleaned by now that Simon Munnery is one of my very favourite comics in the world. He was a huge part of why I started doing comedy. I've tried not to gush or be too fanboy-y when I was talking to him in the garden of his beautiful house, and the beautiful garden with freshly sorted soil, sieved soil in his garden, for goodness sake. So I tried not to gush too much. I didn't always succeed, but it is... I mean, you know, if you've listened to the show, you will have heard the sheer number of times I use him as an example, quote his wisdom, quote his jokes to use as examples for things, or generally bang on about how much I'm a fan of his work. I came away from that interview absolutely buzzing, so don't miss out on that one. Next week, episode 200 and God knows, 213, is it? Even is that possible? With Mr. Simon Munnery. So listen out for that. Thank you very much for listening. Donate at comedianscomedian.com/donate. You can support the show and make me feel as good for doing the show as you feel for listening to it. Is that reasonable? Seems pretty reasonable. Thank you, everybody. And I will keep chatting to you if you'd like to stick around for a moment for the postamble. But for now, that concludes the podcast. I'll speak to you soon. Okay, well, here we go. I had a preview last night where it all came together. I had the one. I had every year I do a show. I record all of my gigs for quality and training purposes. I record all the previews so I can listen back to them in a cafe on my own the next day. And I listen to them, and I don't know how you note your previews or your recordings if you make them, but I normally title them with, you know, with the show I'm working on, so that I can just sort of scroll to it. This is dull but true. So Like I Mean It This Year, the acronym is LIMI, so I'll tag it LIMI, and then the name of the town I was in, the name of the venue, and then I will say something like, some good bits, ? Or, the flexitarian bit worked well, listen back anyway. I frequently do that. If it wasn't great, I go, there was one bit in the middle. You try and give yourself a little note, so when you look back down them, you make yourself listen back to them. And I'm normally quite good. I think the vast majority of guests on this show go, oh, I record them and never listen back. I'm normally pretty good. Tell you what, just as a little precursor, when we get to the Ivan Aristegueta podcast, you are going to completely revolutionise the way you look at comedy writing. It's one of the ones that I don't want to release. Dara, Adam Bloom, Gary Delaney, the ones I would rather just hoard for myself. It really is one of those in terms of not just technical writing, but his whole approach. Anyway, lots to look forward to there. But every year, in between all of my various previews and making notes of things, there is always one preview where I just write the title of the show, as if to say to myself, this is it. It's a show now. This is the show Like I Mean It. Last night, I had that preview at the spectacular Bristol Underground Comedy Club. I was following Spencer Jones, who you know as well as I do, is one of the best. Just one of the best. I'm just going to end up the sentence there. He's just one of the best. And I urge you with every breath in my body to check out his show whenever you can. And he's all over YouTube. He's done bits of telly and stuff, but do see him live. He's fantastic. So I was already nervous about following him. I was coming from another preview. Did two previews last night, which sounds nuts, but I've got into the habit now. When I do the tour, I often do like an hour and then 45, or an hour and then an hour. And you sort of go, yeah, you kind of get match fit for it. It's quite exciting to think you could belt out that much work in one night. So I came from another preview with the brilliant Martin Pilgrim. I did that preview, legged it off, and then turned up in this tiny little sweaty hot box, which is peak Edinburgh conditions, to an audience who'd already seen someone be incredible for an hour. And listen, I'm going to level with you, right? I try to keep you as engaged with my process as I can, obviously, within the parameters that I tell you about the spectacularly bad gigs, right? Because they're infrequent. But sometimes there are just sort of generally tough ones, or generally tired ones, or I'm losing faith in the show, and or losing faith in some elements of the show. I mean, this year, I feel like I've had less time than I have in the last... This is my seventh hour of stand-up, and I have worked on it. I've had less physical time to work on it than any of the previous six. And that has been scaring me. In part, that's because of the Boutros and the wedding and going to Melbourne and the tour being longer. And the travel involved in the tour, you can't always sit and get the writing done to mean that the new stuff you do in the tour the following night is appreciably different. It's been hard. It's been really hard. And partly it's because, as you know, due to the new Hell Week plan, I've tried to change the way I work. I've tried to 4-hour work week my writing year. so that I've done short bursts of intense work rather than the usual kind of, I mean, let's not call it the daily grind, but I do for a long time. My process was turn up every day, write every day. I simply don't have the time to do that anymore. So part of it is also me having to not have a speed wobble and think, okay, I'm doing this differently. So if it isn't ready by early June in the way that it might normally be, then that's not a problem because I'm doing it differently. All of this has contributed to a real and painful, a worrisome and very difficult to live with. Sorry, Mrs. Stew. It's contributed to a real nervous energy. A nervous energy with which all comedians who do the Edinburgh Festival will be familiar at this time of year. But I don't always share that with you, right? If I've had a disaster, do you remember this time last year? I had one that was so bad. And I told you it was the one I started narrating. God, I'll never release that. I started narrating to the recording how badly I was dying. That upset them. Of course it did. They hated me. I hated myself. I remember at the time likening it to just grabbing the stick on the cockpit of a plane and just hurtling towards the ground. I told you about that one, but if there are tougher ones along the way, if they're just kind of, if it's not a story, if it's not interesting that I bombed, or if I didn't bomb, I just like, it was fine. I try not to mention it because obviously I've got a stake in this, right? I want you to come and see me do stand-up. I want you, part of the message of the show is, hey guys, you know, I'm an interviewer that you like listening to. I'm also a really good comic. We know in the past I've been through various modes of being too self-deprecating, sort of assuming a certain amount of skill on my part. And then if I say to you guys, I just turned up, did my little show. Maybe I'm being cool about it, but you don't know. You've never seen me. So maybe you read that as, he's actually not very good. Listen, I can't tell you the whole truth the whole time because I know you might want me to. Someone like Bill Burr on his Monday Morning podcast, if he has a rough gig, he can tell you about it because he's already hugely established. I don't have, whatever my relationship with you, I don't have that level of your unshakable faith in my ability, right? So if there are slightly tougher ones along the way, if they're not excitingly tougher, I keep shtum. I've been worried. I got a text from a fabulous comedian friend of mine who I won't name because it's a running joke between us that he's too scared to come on the show, but he knows full well who he is. I got a text from my friend and he said, how's it going? And I said, I'm really bricking it this year. And he said, but no, everything you said, he texted me back. He said, everything you said on the podcast, it sounds like it's going great. And I had to say, no, I know that. I'm trying to give the impression to everyone that it is going great. But it's only sometimes going great. It's been hard. Now, I had the one last night. You know, you talk about killing your darlings. You're familiar with that phrase? You sometimes, to be creative, to be in an artistic life, you have to look at work you've made that you're in love with and go, nope, get rid. This has been the process of the long knives. I don't think I've ever cut so much functioning stuff. I've cut stuff because it's really good and it gets a round of applause, but it doesn't suit the show. Jesus, I'm trying to, what, who do I think I am? Acaster? I'm trying to mimic that kind of quality control where you go, this bit is perfectly good and works really well, but this isn't the show for it. Take it out. This bit, I love doing this bit, but it's not as fresh now as it was. Take it out. This other bit, come on, that's the guts of the show. And if I take that out, then I lose that amazing callback later. Take it out. I've been chopping and chopping and chopping. I've tried to be merciless. And as a result, last night, I ended up with a show where almost every single bit of it was just the funniest two sentences on that bit and move on. And I cannot tell you enough, this is my reward, if you're a British comic, you're listening to this, you're getting ready for Edinburgh, and if you're the sort of person that listens to every episode and the post ambles, because I know Orlando's profile isn't huge over in the UK just yet, I'm putting this message at the end of this one, that this post amble is a little treat, this is just my message to you. Kill your darlings. Cut the stuff. Cut. And I still ended up last night doing an hour, so I've got to cut another 15 out of that so that I can let it breathe for the next 3 or 4 weeks. And that is a giddying premise. That's a giddying idea. It's like, oh, I've really got it. I've been brutal and it hurt, but God, it worked. So I'm going to be more brutal. Cut to next week's postamble, where you hear me weeping and going, I've got nothing left. I've cut it all and I don't know where I am. And I'm just sat in a barren desert surrounded by tiny little snippets of my former show. So anyway, if you're going to come to Edinburgh, you're going to love this one. I'm so excited about it. I was excited when I wrote all the promo that said how excited I was. And then there was a rocky patch, a long old rocky patch. And now I am back on the tiny horse. I'll speak to you soon.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.